Okay, skipping along. Friday, November 15th, 1968, 5 days after it happened, the New York Times interviewed Haynes at, quote, The Club, a plush dining and drinking place high above Birmingham's south side on Red Mountain. Haynes was a little philosophical, a little more specific, and disclosed a little more about himself, Ray, and the Ray family. In addition to his career as an FBI agent, Haynes is also, quote, a one-time contract employee of the Central Intelligence Agency, unquote. Harold Weisberg puts it in parentheses, part of the CIA's Bay of Pigs preparations were in Birmingham. Okay, skipping on down a little bit farther. Mr. Haynes said that they, meaning the people trying to figure out exactly what had happened in this case, said they could think of only two groups that they considered capable of carrying out this type of plan, namely a conspiracy to murder Dr. Martin Luther King, the CIA and black militants with red Chinese or Cuban backing. In other words, he's saying that either the CIA could have done it or black militants with red Chinese, or in other words, black militants with communist backing. He quickly eliminated his former employer, the CIA. Mr. Haynes decided that he and his son should undertake Ray's defense, notwithstanding their conclusion that they should proceed on the assumption that the murder had been plotted and financed by what he called, quote, black militants with foreign ties, unquote. The New York Times apparently found it not at all unusual that this soaring spirit, so restrained in its anti-communism by FBI employment, was willing to defend a member of a, quote, communist conspiracy. This is a mite stronger than the, quote, communist-inspired demonstrations he found so reprehensible. There he used dogs. This is a conspiracy to kill a great public figure by, quote, black militants with red Chinese or Cuban backing. A conspiracy to tear the country asunder. With that $100,000 to Butrus, his principal, Haynes was willing to defend the man he presumed a communist dupe, and defend them through him. In other words, in Weisberg's somewhat awkward syntax, what he is saying that here is Arthur Haynes, who believed that King was the great inspirer of unrest in Birmingham, that as mayor of Birmingham, Haynes had turned Bull Connor loose with the dogs and the water fire hoses and beatings and other things on blacks who were demonstrating for equality and the voting right and things of that nature in Birmingham. Haynes, who believed that all these things were inspired by communism, that people, the blacks in particular, would never get up off of their knees unless they were inspired by communists. Here's Haynes also claiming that it would have to be either somebody as technically competent and well-funded as the CIA or black militants backed by communists who killed Martin Luther King. So he came to the conclusion that it was the communists who had Martin Luther King killed, and yet he was going to defend James Earl Ray, ostensibly in the pay of the communists, to make white society look bad in the United States.
Okay, now recall also that in addition to being an FBI agent who had resigned the FBI because they would not properly let him express his anti-communist sentiments, and of course his anti-communist sentiments involved the conviction that the civil rights movement itself was communist-inspired, It was just in the passage that Niptuck read you that Arthur Haynes, first attorney for James Earl Ray, defender of the 16th Street Baptist Church culprits, Baptist Church bombing culprits, was also a contract agent for the CIA. By the way, that does not mean that he was a hired assassin. Some people mistake the mob term putting a contract out on somebody, in other words, having them killed, to they extend that to the term contract agent. What that refers to is the fact that he was not a full-time CIA employee, at least not on record, but that rather he was hired to do a particular job. Now, the part of the CIA's Bay of Pigs operation, and recall the connections between Jack Youngblood and the anti-Castro Cuban efforts, connections between Sturgis and Youngblood and the whole complex, that it basically tying in the Bay of Pigs operation with the assassination of President Kennedy. Keep all of those things in mind. Specifically, the aspect of the Bay of Pigs operation which was tied into Birmingham, Alabama, was the recruitment of pilots to fly World War II vintage B-26 bombers as air support for the Bay of Pigs operation. Now, in our Guns of November broadcast, we discussed an article by former Air Force focal point officer Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty. Prouty, the term Air Force focal point officer, refers to the fact that He was the Air Force officer to be recruited by CIA, but to be used by CIA as a liaison officer for the recruitment and employment of any aircraft or Air Force personnel for CIA covert operations. Basically, anytime the CIA needed Air Force units or personnel, Fletcher Prouty was the man they went to. He was a veteran of many, many covert operations, and in an article about the Bay of Pigs, Prouty states a number of things. Recall that this was covered in our Guns of November broadcast. Prouty states that the Bay of Pigs operation was not only not sanctioned by any president, that Eisenhower had ordered that no actions be taken against Castro, so that at least during the final days of his administration, so that the incoming president would not inherit any ongoing operations. Prouty states that the whole operation, the Bay of Pigs, that is, was put together by an insider's cabal, as he termed it, headed by a group of veteran intelligencers overseen by then Vice President Richard Nixon. And that,
incidentally, of course, it should be mentioned that Richard Nixon was expected to be the president in 1960 after Eisenhower left office, so it was thought to be a smooth transition from Eisenhower, who was perhaps a little less confrontative, to Richard Nixon, who many people feel would have been quite at home with an invasion of Cuba.
All right, now, recall that one of the things that Prouty discusses in connection with the Bay of Pigs operation is the fact that the original plan called for air support to be provided by a number of propeller-driven B-26 bombers. Those were World War II vintage aircraft, to be specially fitted with 50 caliber machine guns. These were to be used against ground forces in the Bay of Pigs operation. Prouty distinguishes very carefully between air cover and air support. Many people have faulted President Kennedy for not providing air cover for the operation. According to Prouty, air cover, which refers to action by one's own aircraft against enemy aircraft, would not have been necessary if the plan had gone through. That the original plan for the operation, for the Bay of Pigs invasion, that is, called for these B-26 bombers to destroy Fidel Castro's Air Force while on the ground. Had the plan been followed, there would have been no Cuban aircraft for air cover to there would have been no necessity for air cover because there would have been no Cuban aircraft. Now, one of the things that Prouty maintains, and he was in the chain of communication for the Bay of Pigs operation, was that the Bay of Pigs operation was deliberately deep-sixed by a person or persons within the Central Intelligence Agency. And he specifically cites a fellow, the deputy director of the CIA, a fellow named General Charles P. Cabell, last name C-A-B-E-L-L. He attributes the failure of the B-26, basically an order was withheld to allow the B-26s to neutralize Castro's Air Force. That Air Force then shot down the B-26 bombers and also was instrumental in foiling the Bay of Pigs operation. Now, Prouty says that Charles Cabell was the fellow who withheld the order for the strike which would have neutralized Castro's Air Force. And as we saw in the Guns of November, Charles Cabell was also a key CIA operative involved in recruiting various mafiosi in some assassination plots against Fidel Castro. As we also have seen, according to Johnny Roselli, one of the key mafiosi recruited by this Cabell-led CIA group, the assassination teams recruited originally to get Castro apparently were involved against President Kennedy. And shortly after testifying to that effect, Johnny Roselli was found dismembered and floating in a steel drum in Biscayne Bay. Now, keep in mind the alleged involvement, according to Prouty, of Cabell in withholding the airstrike that would have neutralized Castro's Air Force. Also, the fact that Cabell was involved in the alleged recruitment of the assassination teams that apparently were ultimately involved in some capacity in the assassination of President Kennedy, and that his brother, Earl Cabell, was the mayor of Dallas, Texas, who helped arrange Kennedy's motorcade route and was in the motorcade himself, which led Jim Garrison to suspect that maybe Earl Cabell, as well as Charles Cabell, was involved in the assassination of President Kennedy. Now, this goes back to Arthur Haynes because it involved basically the Birmingham Air National Guard, which was one of the last units to use B-26s, last U.S. Air Force units to use B-26s that our Mr. Arthur Haynes enters the story, because it was in Birmingham, Alabama, that a number of the pilots involved in the B-26 raids against Castro, or the abortive B-26 raids that should have neutralized his Air Force, that the Birmingham Air National Guard was involved in it. This is the complex in which Arthur Haynes is involved. This information is covered in a book called The Invisible Government, co-authored by two men named David Wise and Thomas B. Ross. And The Invisible Government was published in hardcover by Random House and copyrighted in 1964. Okay, David Wise, Thomas B. Ross, The Invisible Government. And recall the whole tangle of CIA, Bay of Pigs, the assassination of President Kennedy, and the CIA contract agent Arthur Haynes, who was James Earl Ray's first lawyer. Recall again that there were supposedly no political motives for any of our political assassinations and no connections between them. As we can see, many of the people who crop up in connection with these cases all go back to common sources. Reading from The Invisible Government. The four women referred to here are the widows of four pilots lost in the Bay of Pigs operation. Recall, they were lost because the order to neutralize Castro's Air Force was withheld by Cabell. Many people, including the anti-Castro Cuban community, blame Kennedy for deep-sixing the Bay of Pigs operation by not providing air cover. Recall that Prouty says that had the plan been followed, there would have been no need for air cover. Reading from The Invisible Government. The husbands of these four women were Thomas Willard Ray, Leo Francis Baker, Riley W. Schamberger Jr., and Wade Carroll Gray, the American CIA airman who had died on April 19, 1961, while flying in combat at the Bay of Pigs. One key to the mystery of all that has since happened to the widows could be found in a small two-story building on a quiet, palm-lined street in Miami Springs, Florida, not far to the north of Miami International Airport. It was, the sign out front proclaimed, the law office of Alex E. Carlson, C-A-R-L-S-O-N. Carlson, a big, blonde, heavy-set man towering well over 6 feet, saw 3 years of combat during World War II in New Guinea, the Philippines, and Okinawa. After the war, he got his bachelor's degree in Spanish at the University of Michigan. By 1952, Carlson, then 27, was finishing law school at the University of Miami. That year he went to Chile on an exchange scholarship. He then returned to Miami and set up practice in Miami Springs. Most of his clients appeared to be obscure airline and air cargo firms operating out of Miami International Airport. But Carlson's most intriguing business activity was the Double Check Corporation. According to the records of the Florida Secretary of State at Tallahassee, this firm was incorporated on May 14, 1959, and quote, "Brokerage is the general nature of business engaged in," unquote. The officers of the Double Check Corporation, as of 1963, were listed as, quote, "Alex E. Carlson, President, 145 Curtis Parkway, Miami Springs, the address of Carlson's law office. Earl Sanders, Vice President, same address. Marjorie Carlson, Secretary Treasurer, same address. The resident agent," unquote, was listed as Wesley R. Pillsbury at the same address.
Skipping down, in 1960, the CIA, having been given the green light by President Eisenhower to organize the Cuban exiles, began looking about for American pilots to serve as PIs, pilot instructors. Because the Cubans would be flying the CIA B-26s, the agency wanted Americans who had flown the plane in wartime. The CIA decided to do its recruiting through Alex E. Carlson and the Double Check Corporation. The agency uses cover of this sort when it recruits pilots for a covert operation. To find the pilots, the CIA naturally turned to the Air National Guard in Alabama, Virginia, and Arkansas, the last state units to fly the obsolescent B-26. From these states, some two dozen pilots were signed up by the CIA, acting through Double Check. The majority were from Alabama, and in turn the bulk of these were from the Birmingham area. The unit's doctor was from Montgomery. General Reed Doster, D-O-S-T-E-R, the congenial bulldog-faced commanding officer of the Alabama Air National Guard, was a key man in the CIA operation at Red Hal Hulu. Doster had left the CIA and was back running the Alabama Air Guard in its 117th Reconnaissance Wing as of 1963. Because the Alabama Air Guard was under the supervision of the 9th Tactical Air Force at Shaw Air Force Base, South Carolina, Doster went to see Major General David W. Hutchinson, the commanding general there. He asked for a leave of absence for himself and about a dozen of his men in the Alabama National Guard. Hutchinson approved the leaves of absence. The men, including Doster, joined the CIA as civilians.
Okay, now, again, let's recap some of this information because it's pretty complex. Arthur Haynes, the fellow who contracted for a book about James Earl Ray with author William Bradford Huey, former FBI agent who resigned the FBI because they wouldn't let him express his anti-communist sentiments. He represents the men convicted in the killing of Viola Liuzzo, a white civil rights worker who was killed, according to the people convicted, by an undercover FBI informant. He also represents the men convicted in the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church, connected in a transcript that we read you to the assassination of President Kennedy and the assassination of Martin Luther King. He was the mayor of Birmingham when that bombing occurred, was the mayor of Birmingham when Sheriff Bull Connor unleashed the full measure of police savagery on the civil rights demonstrators, felt that the civil rights movement was a communist conspiracy, felt that the communists were behind the killing of Dr. Martin Luther King, and yet was willing to defend the man who apparently was used by them, thereby defending the communists to whom he was so bitterly opposed. Arthur Haynes is also a former CIA contract agent, and his roots go back to the very same Bay of Pigs operation, and specifically the air units involved in that operation that we've looked at in connection with the assassination of President Kennedy. And, of course, the interesting thing to contemplate is that if Arthur Haynes was opposed to Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement, would he have been in any way motivated to have helped cover up a conspiracy against Dr. Martin Luther King? Now, the next James Earl Ray lawyer we're going to look at is a fellow named J.B. Stoner, Jesse B. Stoner, the head of the National States Rights Party, which is an ultra-right-wing organization which recruits its members from people who feel that the Ku Klux Klan is too moderate. So that'll give you an idea of just what they're about. And Jesse Stoner, of course, head of the National States Rights Party. Joseph Adams Miltier was the Georgia representative of that party, the subject of the transcript we read you earlier.
All right, so when we come back, we're going to talk again about these two. Well, actually, we're going to talk about three more of James Earl Ray's lawyers. J.B. Stoner, head of the National States Rights Party. We're going to talk about Percy Forman briefly, and we're going to talk about Mark Lane. So all that's coming up. Meanwhile, we're going to take another short break. This is Nip Tuck for Dave Emery, and we will be back in just a few moments with more of Radio Free America right here on Talk a little bit more about some of Martin Luther King's attorneys. In the first hour, we more or less outlined the paucity of the case against Martin Luther King's alleged assassin, James Earl Ray, but we also talked about the rather strange connections of some of the people who appear to have been involved on the side, despite the fact that the state alleges that it was a single lone gunman. As we've seen, there are a bunch of other people who seem to have been involved, and as a matter of fact, many people who seem to have had better credentials to be the assassin than James Earl Ray, one of them being Jack Youngblood that we talked about, a former CIA agent, a former Guatemalan coup respondee, I suppose you'd say somebody involved in the Guatemalan coup that the CIA engineered in 1954. We've seen a variety of these people come to light, and we've seen a variety of CIA ties to the Klan and various other violent groups. We've seen ties between the FBI and these violent groups, and we've seen ties between organized government, organized crime, and drugs and gun shipments and allegations of that sort. And apparently the case is a lot deeper. Now, as we talked about, interestingly enough, here's this man, James Earl Ray, who, as we mentioned, moved around the country seemingly with impunity for some year and a half before the assassination of Martin Luther King, came up with some thousands of dollars of money that there's no way to account for. The only story that we've been given is James Earl Ray's own, which is that he was given it to participate in smuggling operations on behalf of a man from Montreal by the name of Raoul. And most of his stories about Raoul and the drug smuggling appear to have been checked out by various people and to have proved true. We've also seen the allegations of one Robert Byron Watson, currently in jail himself on drug charges, who claims that he was framed and claims that a group of people involved in drug smuggling were wrapped up in the assassination attempt on Martin Luther King. Most of his drug allegations have been proved, however, The police force that was trying to investigate his other allegations about government cooperation with these various drug smugglers and their involvement with Martin Luther King, the police forces said that they could not get the information out of the FBI and others necessary to find and discover the truth of these charges. Then, after James Earl Ray was dumped off the plane from London on what would have to be called false premises because of the extradition request, insinuated that the government had good witnesses to place James Earl Ray at the site of the assassination, and as we've seen, the only witness they had was an alcoholic who had twice earlier testified completely differently as to his whereabouts and as to who he had seen at the scene of the crime, and then later changed his tune when he was being put up by the police at taxpayer expense to the tune of $31,000. We're going to talk about that witness a little more and his common law wife as we talk about the three remaining attorneys we want to speak of as pertains to James Earl Ray. The first one we're going to talk about is a man by the name of J.B. Stoner, or Jesse Stoner, as Dave mentioned earlier, the head of the National States Rights Party. As mentioned earlier, when we read from the Miltier document, two men, one of them a police informant, discussing the possibility of an assassination of John F. Kennedy from an office building, the possibility of shooting somebody on a hotel balcony, the possibility of shooting Martin Luther King, and the involvement of these same people in the 16th Street church bombings in Birmingham, Alabama during the civil rights struggle. During which time, as we mentioned, Ray's first attorney, Arthur Haynes, was the mayor of Birmingham and very anti-civil rights and anti-Martin Luther King. Well, we were talking about all these things, and now we're going to hear about another one of his attorneys, a man by the name of J.B. Stoner. And right here, specifically, we're reading from Patsy Sims' book, The Klan, and talking about HUAC, which is House Un-American Activity, House Un-American Activities Committee hearings, on the subject of the Klan and on the subject of various right-wing racist groups and J.B. Stoner's contacts to them and any contacts that he might have had to the 16th Street bombings.
Okay, well, now the Klan, of course, were called published copyrighted 78 Scarborough books by Philadelphia Inquirer reporter Patsy Sims. Now, remember, Arthur Haynes connected 16th Street Baptist Church, CIA, FBI, Viola Liuzzo, fiercely anti-Martin Luther King, fiercely anti-communist, yet apparently willing to cover up a communist conspiracy, or so he says, in order to protect James Earl Ray, the state's suspect, the state's patsy for the assassination of Martin Luther King. Now, section here, which we're going to be reading, comes again from The Klan by Patsy Sims, deals with the involvement of Jesse Stoner with the House Un-American Activities Committee hearing and also connections to the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing and the assassination of Martin Luther King.
That's right. And as mentioned earlier, the man Miltier, who was the subject of the surreptitious taping of the Miltier document, was the Georgia representative of the same National States Rights Party of which J.B. Stoner was the leader. Okay, reading from Patsy Sims, The Klan. During the HUAC hearings, again, House Un-American Activities Committee, during the HUAC hearings, Donald Appel questioned Stoner on his knowledge or involvement in the 16th Street church blast and in two explosions 10 days later that, Appel contended, were intentionally set, quote, to injure FBI agents and other law enforcement personnel in retaliation for their vigorous investigation of the church bombing, including the questioning of many Klan suspects, unquote. When Stoner refused to answer, citing his constitutional rights, Appel proceeded to, quote, place him in Birmingham, quote, immediately prior to and including September 15, 1963, and in March and April of 1965, when a series of bombs were uncovered in that city. Besides the bombing ties, one investigator also had commented, you know Stoner's part of the conspiracy in King's death, don't you? Unquote. Over the years, Stoner had slithered from one right-wing group to another, speaking before meetings and rallies, representing their members in court, sharing offices. His ties were like a bowl of venomous spaghetti. Was there an underground right-wing network that perhaps had plotted King's assassination and other violence? On several occasions, Robert Shelton and Robert Depew, former leader of the Minutemen, announced plans for such a network. And a meeting supposedly was held in Kansas City, Missouri, with Shelton and David Duke, among others, present. By the way, I should just mention in parentheses, there have been numerous suggestions, rather well-founded, that David Duke himself, although a prominent Klan leader, has also been a CIA agent. In 1976, Tony Larici, L-A-R-I-C-C-I, also had told the press about the formation of a coalition of right-wing groups in Maryland. The FBI and many law enforcement officials scoffed at the idea of such a network existing, even in view of the Shelton Depew efforts and a coming together of right-wing leaders from around the world at an international congress convened by David Duke in New Orleans in September 1976. Were they wrong, or were they concealing information? Was there indeed such a network? And could J.B. Stoner be the knot that tied the pieces together? Was he the key to more than the bombings? Was he part of a conspiracy? Was his tie to James Earl Ray more than that of attorney and friend of Ray's brother Jerry? And it should be mentioned, of course, that James Earl Ray's brother Jerry, one of the people who had been active in finding James Earl Ray's various attorneys, James Earl Ray's brother Jerry was a bodyguard to J.B. Stoner.
Okay, and again, maintain the links between J.B. Stoner and Arthur Haynes to the 16th Street Baptist Church bombings, the links between that, the Martin Luther King assassination, the assassination of President Kennedy, Haynes' work for CIA on behalf of Bay of Pigs, that connection to the assassination of President Kennedy, all of that from a document, a transcript of the Georgia representative of the National States Rights Party, and recall also the fact that, well, as we're going to see here, as you try to keep all of that in mind, that James Earl Ray's brother Jerry was a bodyguard for J.B. Stoner. Reading from The Klan by Patsy Sims, my speculations were bolstered in January of 1978 when the House Assassinations Committee indicated it would subpoena Stoner, along with several National States Rights Party associates, to testify in its investigation into the murder of Martin Luther King Jr. An unidentified congressional source told the press that the panel wanted to find out whether Stoner's activities, quote, are in any way directly connected with the assassination of Dr. King. The source indicated the committee would question Stoner both about his allegations that an FBI informant had offered him $25,000 to have King killed and $2,000 to blow up the Birmingham church, and about his relationship with James Earl Ray. A month later, the New York Times disclosed that Ray's brother Jerry was acting as bodyguard for Stoner, who announced he would again run for governor of Georgia. So, look at all the links between these people and their connections not only to far right-wing groups who would conspire against the life of Dr. Martin Luther King, but also who would their connections with intelligence agencies and the whole tangle of events that we've been looking at in connection with the Magellan Art Gallery and Jack Youngblood and so forth.
Also, a thing to look at from an objective point of view as possible is the possibility now that somebody might raise that, well, if James Earl Ray was a white supremacist, despite all the evidence that had been offered by other people, it might make sense that he, in fact, would be hiring lawyers who are white supremacists themselves. However, one would also then conjecture, if you're going to take that route, one would say, well, then what would be the purpose? The purpose would be either A, to try and get him off, or B, to try and use the courtroom as a forum to sell the white supremacist point of view, and perhaps to make some excuses for the killing of Martin Luther King as being necessary for national security, or whatever the case may be. Anyway, the upshot was that despite all of these supposedly pro-James Earl Ray white supremacist attorneys, none of them succeeded in preventing. As a matter of fact, most of them succeeded in actually enabling James Earl Ray's railroading into court on a two-hour trial in which his own objections to the plea of guilty with no conspiracy were muzzled by his lawyer and the judge. Got him in jail for 99 years with very little possibility of getting out, and in fact got him no opportunity to tell his story whatsoever. So one would certainly have to ask what good it did James Earl Ray to hire a bunch of white supremacist attorneys if that in fact was his wish. Anyway, going back to the essay that we've been quoting from frequently during the evening, The Assassination of Martin Luther King by Jeff Cohen from the from Government by Gunplay, James Earl Ray felt that by firing Haynes, this is his first lawyer, he would be rid of Huey. That's William Bradford Huey, the writer, who had contracted with James Earl Ray and his lawyer Haynes to write a book about James Earl Ray's quote-unquote assassination of Martin Luther King. But Ray's attorney James Laser, or Leeser, L-E-S-A-R, this is a later attorney, asserted, quote, after Foreman, that's Percy Foreman, another attorney we've mentioned a few times, had denounced Haynes' contract with Huey, he turned around and made the same deal with the author. Okay, so what he's saying, this later attorney Lizar is saying, is that Percy Forman came in, denounced the contract that lawyer Haynes had made with William Bradford Huey, and which many people feel was then used as an excuse to railroad James Earl Ray into prison so that he would not disrupt the book sales for William Bradford Huey by daring to proclaim his innocence or something. Anyway, Percy Forman comes in, big famous trial lawyer, denounces Haynes' contract, then turns around and makes the same contract himself. John Ray testified about Forman's first comments on the case. Quote, Forman mentioned how he and Ramsey Clark, who was then Attorney General, were good friends. He said there was no evidence against Jimmy, that he'd have Jimmy walking the streets in no time. Forman said he'd get hold of TV films of King, cities burning, rioting, and play them for the jury. After 2 weeks, the jury would want to shoot King themselves. He said he's an attorney who plays on the jury's emotions, unquote. So according to John Ray, Percy Forman first said there was no evidence against James Earl Ray, then turns around and says he's going to convince the jury that they should want to shoot King themselves and that King was the cause of these cities burning and all these riots, which again sounds very similar to what Arthur Haynes felt about Martin Luther King's responsibility for black unrest. Skipping down, Forman later told Ray's brothers that, quote, he didn't want Jimmy to testify because he'd talk about conspiracy, unquote, according to John Ray. Percy Forman, who was once Jack Ruby's attorney, claimed that if there was evidence of a conspiracy, quote, Jimmy would look like a guilty party. Now, here's two key things to look at. First of all, James Earl Ray has been railroaded into prison, He's being told that he should not talk about conspiracy because it might get him the chair. He's basically being threatened with a chair by his own attorneys to get him not to talk about conspiracy, despite all the evidence suggesting conspiracy. Second of all, as we're going to note in just a moment, Percy Forman had also once been Jack Ruby's attorney, and the merry-go-round spins round and round. Okay.
Now, basically, we're going to take a look at a short section again, going back to Frame Up by Harold Weisberg. We're going to take a look at why Percy Forman was dismissed as Jack Ruby's attorney.
Okay, from Frame Up. Forman represented Mrs. Singleton, this is another case they're talking about, for only 18 days, but that is more than four times as long as the 4 days he had the case of Jack Ruby, the man who shot Lee Harvey Oswald. In resigning from Ruby's defense, he wrote, quote, you know, I don't let people tell me what to do in a case. That is his version. It is subject to a different interpretation that should be borne in mind when we analyze his handling of the Ray case. He could have been saying that his clients do what he tells them. He does not do what they desire. Now, bear in mind, too, as long as we're bringing up the subject of Jack Ruby and the killing of Lee Harvey Oswald, we've talked before about the massive evidence suggesting that Lee Harvey Oswald was a dupe of some kind. Like James Earl Ray, he steadfastly maintained his innocence, unlike the supposed psychological profile of the lone gunman nut type. Lee Harvey Oswald was shot by Jack Ruby, who then, in his prison cell, told Earl Warren and large parts of the Warren Commission that he had to be taken out of Dallas, that he couldn't tell what he knew in Dallas, that there was a massive change coming over the country politically, and that his people, Ruby was a Jew, would be in real danger, and that Earl Warren must get him, Jack Ruby, to President Johnson to talk about what had happened in the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Well, anyway, Percy Forman declined to represent Jack Ruby for more than 4 days, considering the fact that he suggested that that James Earl Ray not talk about conspiracy. It could be that he was made rather uncomfortable by Jack Ruby's allegations of conspiracy. Jack Ruby, by the way, as soon as his death sentence was commuted, immediately caught cancer and died rather quickly thereafter.
Okay, now recall also that Jack Ruby and some of his testimony before the Warren Commission, or members of it, you heard on the Guns of November, that he was going to some length to attempt to show that he was part of a conspiracy, that his lawyers, among them Melvin Belli and a fellow by the name of Joe Tannehill, did not appear very anxious to have him say that. Now that fits in with the same kind of pattern that Forman has here.
Oh, and not to mention the fact that Jack Ruby himself, of course, had long ties to organized crime, including growing up in Chicago as a runner for the Al Capone organization, later on becoming affiliated with various crime families and having heavy dealings in pre-Castro Cuba, where so many of these things were turned to. Ruby himself made trips to Cuba and had connections with numerous Cuban mafia figures with bases in the Cuban gambling operations. And as so many other people came out of the Cuban gambling operations and later cropped up in the Kennedy assassination, here we're seeing another tie back to the Cuban associations and to the lawyer for Lee Harvey Oswald's killer, Jack Ruby, being the same lawyer, again, one of the lawyers for James Earl Ray.
Okay, now recall that Jack Ruby also had connections to the intelligence community. He had apparently been involved in some gun running to Cuba, both before Batista fell and afterwards, so he, in addition to organized crime, he also had intelligence connections. Now, one of his lawyers was a fellow named Joe Tannehill, as we looked at in the Guns of November. Joe Tannehill was the son-in-law of one of President Kennedy's most vehement congressional opponents, and therefore might be expected to be less than enthusiastic about exposing a conspiracy against President Kennedy. Now, Percy Forman would not defend Jack Ruby because he wanted to handle Ruby's defense himself, and apparently Forman was quite anxious from the handling of James Earl Ray's case to have James Earl Ray appear guilty. So Forman's conduct here is very, very strange. But we're going to look at another in his connections. The fact that he is Ruby's attorney as well is also very interesting, and we're going to take a look at some other interesting clients here of Percy Forman. Again, reading from The Assassination of Martin Luther King. In 1975, Forman was indicted along with the oil-rich Hunt brothers of Dallas for a conspiracy to obstruct justice in the case of two Hunt-employed wiretappers who Forman allegedly supplied with hush money and pressured to go quietly to jail. Strange conduct for a lawyer. Stranger still that he should be a lawyer for the Hunt brothers. The Hunts and Jack Ruby both crop up, of course, in the assassination of President Kennedy. Both H.L. Hunt and Lamar Hunt and Nelson Bunker Hunt had connections to Jack Ruby and were prominent in the John Birch Society. There are a number of John Birch Society connections to the assassination of President Kennedy, and apparently Jack Ruby was seen to was actually known to have withdrawn some money from an H.L. Hunt controlled bank in Dallas a few days before he killed Jack Ruby or Lee Harvey Oswald.
Okay, one of the other things, of course, interesting about the Hunts that we've dealt with rather recently on such shows as Hard Rain and One Step Beyond is the fact that the Hunt brothers had a very good day in court. And the railroading itself was rather shabbily done. I mean, this wasn't even good railroading, I guess is what I'm trying to say. Okay, on the subject of this particular railroading, one of the things that we mentioned earlier and that we're going to be talking about now in some depth and that you're going to be hearing about in some depth is the fact of Charles Q. Stevens. As we mentioned earlier, Charles Q. Stevens was a roomer in the boarding house from which the shot was allegedly fired. At the time of the assassination, Charles Q. Stevens initially identified, first he claimed that he saw a man come running out of the bathroom where the shot was supposedly fired from, said that the man was, quote, a nigger, and said that, you know, I don't care who, you know, I'm anybody who killed Martin Luther Coon is all right with me, and I wouldn't testify against him even if he is a, quote, nigger. Then, later on, as everybody in the rooming house, including the landlady of the rooming house, and, as we'll find out later, Charles Q. Stevens' common-law wife, Grace Walden, said Stevens was drunk. Everybody knows Stevens was drunk. He had called a cab. He couldn't even get into it. He was so drunk 15 minutes before the assassination. Stevens himself was drunk every day at 6 o'clock. He used to go by the firehouse all intoxicated, and the fireman there testified to that fact. Despite this fact, the next day, a news photographer who was on the scene said that Stevens didn't even remember anybody had been shot the day before. Still in all, after the capture of James Earl Ray, all of a sudden Stevens came forward and became the only person who would say that he had seen James Earl Ray in that upstairs room. The people who had rented the room to the man who went in under the name of Mr. Willard could not link that to James Earl Ray, said it was not the same person. Several people who saw somebody in that room that day said it was not James Earl Ray, but yet Charles Stevens, a complete drunkard who had been, by many eyewitnesses' testimony, drunk beyond the point of comprehension at the time of the assassination, became the only link between James Earl Ray and the assassination site, became the star witness for the state, was the basis on which James Earl Ray was extradited from England, and was the basis basically on which James Earl Ray was actually convicted. And as we'll see, one of the key people impugning the testimony of Charles Q. Stevens was his common-law wife, Grace Walden. Now, one more short bit here from The Assassination of Martin Luther King by Jeff Cohen from Government by Gunplay. On the day the FBI whisked Stevens into protective custody, his common-law wife, Grace Walden, was mysteriously committed to a mental institution by someone in the Memphis city government. 3 years later, a judge ruled that her commitment was illegal and unorthodox. Grace Walden's attorney charged that the FBI, County prosecutor and Memphis police had conspired to commit her in order to destroy her credibility as a witness who could contest contest Stevens's observations. Quote, "They had to get rid of me to make Charlie's story stand up in court," unquote, Ms. Walden told her attorney. She said that Charlie was intoxicated and had almost passed out in the kitchen. Unlike Stevens, Grace Walden's story has never varied. On the night of the murder, she told Chastain that she clearly saw a white man without a rifle leave the bathroom soon after the shot was fired. "It sounded like the shot came from outside her window, not from the bathroom," she said. "The man apparently entered another room down the hall. She heard two doors slam." Ms. Walden described the man as short, only 5'6", small physique, salt and pepper hair, in his 50s and wearing a military field jacket. The small man apparently grabbed the bundle containing Ray's rifle and belongings from the other room, ran down the stairs, and dropped the load, implicating Ray. Bear in mind, again, that the rifle was still in its carton. It is possible that the small man also acted as a lookout, communicating by radio to the sniper perched below in the bushes. This is Cohen guessing. According to the official scenario, Ray supposedly dropped his own possessions, fingerprints and all, a few feet from his getaway car. In Ray's abandoned white Mustang was found male clothing that was several sizes too small for Ray, but that would fit a 125-pound man like the one Walden described. Ray's car ashtrays were found to be filled with Viceroy cigarette butts. Viceroy butts were also discovered in room 5B of the rooming house. James Earl Ray does not, and did not, smoke. Soon after their hookup in Montreal, Raoul gave Ray a New Orleans phone number through which he could be reached in an emergency. 4 months before King was murdered, Raoul had Ray drive from Los Angeles to New Orleans for a brief but important meeting. Ray spent less than 36 hours in New Orleans and returned. James Earl Ray made the L.A. to New Orleans to L.A. round trip with a traveling companion, a Southern California songwriter he had just met in a bar who wanted to visit relatives in New Orleans. The songwriter, Charles Stein, said that Ray talked very little during the 50-hour round trip, but that Ray made several phone calls on the way east. Stein said he was curious and kept a scrap of paper with the phone number. Bernard Fensterwald, one of Ray's lawyers, dialed the number and was startled when he was answered on the other end by a trooper at a Louisiana State Police barracks. Grace Walden later identified before three witnesses, her attorney, a private detective, and journalist Wayne Chastain, a Louisiana State policeman from a photograph as the small man who fled the rooming house.
All righty, now, a couple of things to keep in mind. Now that not only the information massively contradicting Charles Q. Stevens, the drunkard, the fellow who had 155 arrests, the fellow who had $31,000 worth of bar tabs paid for him by the FBI. Remember Grace Stevens, or Grace Walden, she was his common-law wife. She totally contradicted his testimony, as did many other people. Recall the unusual handling of her. She basically was incarcerated. Supposedly she was mentally ill. A thing that's worth noting is that much of the legwork done in investigating the testimony of Charles Stein, the songwriter who had traveled with Ray and who basically was able to provide the telephone number which yielded the Louisiana State Trooper that Bernard Fensterwald came up with or was startled to hear at the other end of that number. Much of the legwork in investigating this particular aspect of the case was done by a noted black author and journalist named Louis Lomax, last name L-O-M-A-X. Shortly after he did this legwork, he died in a very mysterious one-car auto accident. His automobile simply just veered off the road, and he died in the accident. And his wife and lawyer, among others, were convinced that he was murdered because of his investigation into the assassination of Dr. King. And, of course, recalling the Guns of November and the other cases that we examine on this station on the various broadcasts, that witnesses, investigators, key participants in many of these crimes have a way of dying under rather mysterious circumstances.